Welcome to episode 4 of the Service Course Report. We're back in our respective studios. We were together in Carpinteria for episode 3, but here we are, and we're going to get right into the biggest news in the cycling world with the big transfer market and the big transfer season and the news about Remco. This has been brewing on and off for the last 2 years, and it seems to have happened. What do you guys think?
Well, definitely, like you said, it seems like this one's been happening, looking to try and happen for a while. You know, Remco was linked to going, I think, to maybe Bora at one time and then to Ineos, and seemed like he was the hot rider on the market in terms of trying to get a new Grand Tour GC guy. So, you know, I think it makes sense for sure.
I think it makes sense unless you're Florian Leipovitz or Primoz Roglic. It's going to be interesting to see how that all plays out, you know? I mean, even a guy like Jai Hindley, who had won the Giro, being on that team. So, yeah, it should be super interesting to see how that all plays out with him transferring there, you know, and then almost immediately there was talk of Primoz maybe talking with Movistar, like with a mid-season transfer here. I mean, I can't imagine that dude's very pleased. But at the same time, he had 2 years to prove himself at the Tour, and he proved himself.
Yeah. I mean, nothing against him, but you're definitely right. They said this was the first Tour he'd finished since 2020.
Yeah.
So that's kind of hard to bill yourself as. Yeah. What were you going to say, Ed?
Well, he was so interesting in his attitude. He would be all nonchalant in his post-race, interviews, and he was moving up on GC, and then he had, you know, some bad closing mountain days. It was interesting to see how he was riding and behaving. I think he probably knew the news was brewing.
Right, like everybody.
But I think the coolest thing is now Evenepoel will have a team to back him in the Grand Tours. I mean, the only reason he transferred here was because Soudal Quick-Step was unable to put a team together that could support him. You know, even I think we spoke about this previous episode, them going into the Tour with a double-pronged approach, right? They still brought Tim Mellier. UAE doesn't bring a sprinter, you know. Visma doesn't bring a sprinter. I mean, Dylan Groenewegen raced for them before. You know, and he went somewhere else because they focused all in. I mean, those are the only two teams that are all in on the Tour de France with a singular goal, and they've won the last six. Yeah, between those guys. So, I think the days of a team winning the Tour de France without a singular approach, you know, at least for now, it isn't going to happen. We'll see, you know, when these super duper racers, you know, go away and it kind of gets more balanced out. Maybe it'll change, but I think at this point you have to be all in on that.
Yeah. And I think for, you know, Lefebvre running that team, it definitely seemed like ever since they had Remco coming out of juniors, you know, and tested him and they were like, he's our guy. You know, it seemed like it wasn't just that he wanted to win the Tour. I feel like more like Lefebvre was looking at it as his big cash out. Like he could somehow, you know, say, hey, we got a Grand Tour champion and get the team there and sell the team or do something. There was so much wrangling and behind the scenes with him over the years. But ultimately, like you said, they hired a couple individual GC guys, you know, to help him out, like Landa, you know, climbers, Perry-Ponty. But they're, you know, they're a classics team. So you got a lot of guys that can hammer on the front, but not too many guys that can go day after day after day in the mountains and support somebody racing for a win at the Tour. So it definitely makes sense. But, you know, it looks like Quick-Step by their signings, we can talk a little bit more about that, is, you know, they're going back to classics mode.
Yeah. Well, and I bet that, and we spoke about this before, I mean, Specialized probably had a little pull in wanting Remco to go to a team that was still on Specialized, because they have historically followed certain riders. You know, you look at Peter Sagan, you look at Demi Vollering, and we spoke about this before, or, you know, even Contador back in the day. So that's it, you know. And then, you know, Remco can use a lot of the same equipment, the same time trial bike, which I'm sure was super important for him, you know, with his wins in the world championships, you know, wins in the tour, wins at the Olympics, or win at the Olympics in the time trial. Like, that's a big deal. And he's proven his ability to time trial, which is key, you know, along with climbing in these grand tours. So that's got to be huge for him.
He's had 64 wins at Sudal, you know, the world championships. He kind of set the mark of maybe taught Pogačar how to solo early. You know, he won in Australia by going early.
Yeah.
You know, gold medals and the road and time trial. You know, I think, what, four tour stages, mostly time trials, right? Or all time trials.
One grand tour.
He's an amazing rider, and he got them amazing exposure. I enjoyed his social media and the coverage that they did of his career. I thought Sudal did a pretty good job for being kind of a stodgy old world Belgian team.
Right.
They did a good job of marketing him and telling his story. At first, I wasn't a big fan of his, you know, because he was a little grumpy, or he would get into it with the fans or whatever. But I think he comes across like a nice person, or a smart, diligent person in his social media, and his, you know, he has a YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. He's done a good job of telling his story and getting it out there.
Getting his marketing. I think one thing I just popped into my head, I was thinking too, is even though we talked about, you know, how Remco, or we've seen how he did in the tour and all that, I think it should just be noted for the year that he had for that training accident he had, where he got car-doored by the postal vehicle and had nerve damage. And I mean, he didn't even ride outdoors for 3 months or something like that, I think it was. It was a pretty long time. And you think about, for somebody of that level, having to do all of that on the trainer for so long before you could come back. I mean, you look at, you know, Pogačar 223 tour, right? Had a great spring and then broke his wrist at Liège and came to the tour obviously underprepared. There's just only so much you can do if you're not out on your bike. Even though Remco's was earlier in the season, it was a December, I think, training accident. But even still, I mean, you know, we all know from putting seasons together, if you're not able to just get out and put those miles in at that time of the year, that's really hard to do. And the hardest miles to do on a trainer would be your long miles. If you're going in there and having to do stuff on the stationary bike and do hard, high intensity intervals, that's something. But just sitting on there and pedaling all day, he must have had some VR goggles or something to get him through. But, you know, but that's an honorable mention to him on that. And also the other thing I would say, Kurt, you brought up a great point, you know, with Specialized and the continuity for Remco, you know, it's not just the bikes, but you think of its shoes, right? Also, and saddles, which are your contact points. There was when Philippe Gilbert had that year when he was still on Lotto and he won all three of those Ardennes Classics in a year. And he was the hot guy, had been crushing it, and he got signed to BMC. And he had a terrible year the next year. And I remember one of the things he brought up was the fact that they switched everything, including shoe and saddle sponsor. And he really didn't think it would be that big of a deal. But as he got into the year and got training, he had like so many seasons with that same shoe sponsor and everything the same, that sometimes just those teeny tiny little changes can mess you up and you don't even know. It could just be the camber of the shoes or something different, but it can just get you off from having that, you know, that zingy feeling, or as I believe they call it, the great sensations, you know, in the legs.
Yeah.
Stop you from having those awesome sensations.
Yeah. Well, and then too, you know, and he'll be in that same helmet, which, you know, reminds me, we had talked about this a little bit, but I always notice that Remco twists his helmet straps on his road helmet. So he can continue to have those twisted straps. And I've never heard anybody talk about that. It's just something that I've noticed. And so he, you know, I wonder if he'll continue to do that, or if they'll come up with a Remco strap or something on the helmet. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He sure is detailed with his equipment. Like, you know, he's all, you know, the pros are spinning their pedals backwards to start their power meter, but he is very, you can tell he's very detailed, and I'm sure that he's a good fit for Specialized, and the back and forth relationship is a win for both those companies, because he probably gives good feedback.
Right. And they're investing in a rider who will give them back all that data, really help them out. I mean, especially for as good of a time trialist as he is, That's a big one, let alone obviously just like road bikes, shoes, helmets, all of that. But I think, too, to your point, Ed, probably his technical nature is one of the things that makes him a good time trialist. Or maybe he learned along with his good genetics in order to be at that level, of a time trialist, you have to have that much, pay that much attention to all your details. But I think the days of having like a grand tour rider, especially if somebody of that level that can just kind of like wing it and keep the details loose, I think those days are gone. However, it's probably the teams can help people out who maybe are a little less detailed. If your team is really strong that way with the details, then it can help out a rider who maybe isn't quite minded that way.
Yeah. And as it evolves, a rider like him, a point you brought up, yes, that the feedback that he provides to a company like Specialized is invaluable, because the changes are getting smaller and smaller, right? This
right.
What do they call it? Incremental changes or whatever. I mean, little bits and little bits, but when you get to this level, how are the companies going to innovate? Having that valuable feedback. I remember you talking about it with riders in motocross, where they can give feedback to the suspension tuner and really explain to them what's going on with the bike, rather than, oh, dude, it just doesn't work.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, it feels, it doesn't feel right. It's like, I think that, Ed, you bring it up too. It's like, I believe the guy is very detail oriented and it has helped him along. So it'll be super interesting to see how that goes and just see, what happens with the rest of that team. I mean, there are three grand tours every year.
Right.
And something that people don't talk about, it was 22? Remco was in the pink jersey and had to drop out of the Giro with COVID. He's only won the only one. He's won the Vuelta. He's won one Grand Tour, but I mean, he's had some bad luck. The crash he had last winter, the crash he had in 2019 at was at the end of the year at Lombardy. They had some big setbacks, physically, and as we've seen with Wout van Aert, you crash a few times, it takes a little while to come back. And
yeah.
And we only hear what they want us to hear as far as like what really happened in the crash and how the recovery's gone. It takes some time for sure. But obviously there's faith in the guy, and I'm sure these teams have done their research, and it's going to be super exciting moving forward.
Yeah.
He went out to McDonald's with the mechanics during the tour this year and got sick.
maybe no Mickey D's next time.
Yeah.
I don't know. That was one rumor. The other thing is that Red Bull does have Dan Bingham, the guy who held the hour record, who's Mr. Aero Technology, and they hired him away from Ineos about a year ago, and they do have him under contract as their aero tech specialist, so I'm sure that's attractive to Remco. I don't know quite how that'll dovetail with Specialized. The other thought I had was, I kept thinking, well, can Ineos, ride Specialized? Like, because their deal with Pinarello is allegedly up or not right. going to happen again because, 365 is going to ride Pinarello next year because of the ownership of that particular company. Also, that guy owns part of Pinarello. So, what bikes will Ineos ride next year will be interesting to see. And I always thought, well, maybe there's a chance Remco could be on Specialized at Ineos, but that didn't happen. So
right probably easier for Specialized to just keep that team and get a rider over there than to have to do a whole nother team.
Yeah,
if they were to sponsor Ineos and all of that, but yeah, that's going to be interesting to see. I think one interesting thing, and the three of us touched on a little bit, and Kurt, you brought it up before we started, is there's the main riders, right? You talk about Remco's going to Bora. And so what does that mean for Leipowitz and Roglic? And they're talking to other people. And we touched a little bit about, some of the support riders, but I mean, it's definitely a big shift, right? Each rider brings over their crew. You have, the couple climbers that are on Quickstep. Now they're wondering where they're going to go, because I don't see Perry-Ponty like at the front of the Tour of Flanders setting tempo. So, there's a lot of other things that have to fall in place in the other riders. And, Alpecin, they're down one sponsor. I don't remember if it's De Koenig or Alpecin that's pulling out. So they've had to let a few riders go. there a few hopped over to Quickstep. Ed, you have a bit more knowledge of the transfer market, but there are definitely other ripple effects from this one big move as the teams kind of restructure themselves.
Yeah, I read that Jasper Stuyven is going from Lidl Trek over to Quickstep. So that's definitely an indication that they're probably heading back to their true roots and where they've had the majority of their success as a classics team.
The Wolf Pack,
yeah.
Yeah, and circling back to Red Bull, I mean, they got personality problems there. Obviously, you know, they let Rolf Aldag go. And I think he was pretty successful director of that team for many years, in my opinion. I mean, he kind of got them on the map, and he won the Giro with Jai Hindley, who's still on the team. He's 29 years old now. But so, you know, people are running through the possible Bora tour team. So Remco, Primoz, Florian Lipowitz, Jai Hindley, Danny Martinez, Mattia Catiano, Moncasan. Yeah, so that's, you know, will that team be what actually shows up on the start line? Will Primoz jump ship and go somewhere else? You know, it's hard to, it's hard to say. But they got to blend the back end of all these, you know, they got some HR problems on the back end. They got to get in line with making sure that, you know, if I was Lipowitz and I just got third and just beat Remco in the tour, I would be a little upset if they told me, hey, you're going to go to the Giro next year.
No, right. So. Yeah. That's going to be hard to manage. I mean, I guess on the one end, usually everybody showing up fit and ready to win usually doesn't happen. You know, like if you have more than one, that's why they throw them out, you know, throw out a couple multi-pronged approach, maybe even just during the season, because you're not putting all your eggs in one basket. But yeah, I agree with you. If you're Lipowitz, you're kind of going, hey, I just got third in the tour.
True, but how many of the young riders have we seen that have had a great debut or very solid debut, right? Because there was no expectation and nobody was watching them, and they just kind of could do their own thing, and then
not.
Don't see it again. I mean, even the guy like Roman Bardet, right? He finished on the podium at the tour and did that once. You know, was
it twice? Great, I think great, actually,
or twice, right? Third.
Yeah,
yeah. But you know, we had a few different Americans that did that and never came back. You know,
right?
Yeah, TJ had some good tours. You know, Bobby Julich finished on the podium. Vandeveld was fourth. You know, it's one thing, I think. You know, and of course we're looking from the outside, but going in with no expectation and getting a result, but it's completely different going in as the leader and when the pressure is there and 100%. Being able to get the result. So that's definitely one to watch, you know, just how tough mentally the riders are, because that's a huge aspect that sometimes gets touched on, but it's, you know, we hear about it at the tour, but it's from now all the way until the tour starts. All of that, those expectations and those type of things. So yeah, it'll be super fun to watch for sure. But yeah, we'll also have one more Grand Tour this year, right? Oh, sorry. What was that, Ed?
Yeah. Sometimes during the Vuelta, we get excited about a particular rider in that fashion. And then, you know, he can maybe perform at the Vuelta, but he's not going to do it at the Tour or the Giro in the next year or so.
Yeah.
Like Sepp Kuss.
Yeah. Well, isn't it interesting how we're talking about Primoz now? If in fact, right, comes out, he's like talking to Movistar. It was so funny that only 2 years ago was when Visma won all three tours. And then there was just so much talent there that Primoz is like, obviously Vingo won his second tour. So then he's like, okay, I can see the writing on the wall, and definitely got a good payout to go to Bora on that. It's just funny that almost the same cycle would be repeating itself if he, you know, if he goes somewhere else. Too many chefs in the kitchen.
Yeah, well, we'll see where that goes. Yeah, and I apologize. I'm going to say apologize for a little noise coming in. There's a little construction going on not too far out my window. So I'll keep muting the mic when I hear the saw fire up. So
you'll keep throwing items out of the window. Hey,
no, they need to continue doing what they're doing.
Yeah. Well, so that'll be an interesting window to watch all the transfer thoughts from that. I'm sure in coming weeks we'll hear a few more things that fall into shape, into place.
Yeah, Groenewegen is going to Unibet Rockets, whatever that team is, you know, and he's bringing his lead out train with him. There's a few different things happening. Brailsford's supposedly calling the shots for Ineos, and who's the new French hope that kind of faded in the tour?
Oh, wow. Vauquelin.
Kevin Vauquelin. Vauquelin.
He's probably going to Ineos.
Interesting.
And Pitcock's team has signed Fred Wright. Who else did they sign? Eddie Dunbar. That, you know, they're moving on up too. So
right,
there's a lot of changes. And I happen to think we're going to see a Primoz Roglic change, but that's just me.
Yeah. All right. Well, you heard it here.
Maybe by episode 5, we'll know. Yeah, it would be crazy if it changed before the Vuelta, but, you know, stranger things have happened.
This is true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
We've had a lot of recent races going on. We had the Tour de France Femme finishing up. KS, what were your main takeaways from the Femmes?
Well, you know, I was super excited just to watch it because, you know, we're now 4 years into this new format. They went to 9 days this year, so the longest version yet so far. I was a little bit bummed that it overlapped with the last weekend of the men's tour, but, you know, for whatever the logistics were, that's how it happened. You know, and kind of the notes that I have and things that I noticed and watched is personally, I was a little bit concerned. I don't know if concern's the right word. When the first two stages were won by the two oldest riders in the race with Marian Vos, who's like won 250 races now.
Right.
And then Mavi Garcia. But quickly, you know, that changed and the current crop of riders really started to shine. And even some young riders. So, you know, it was a little telling in stage one, you know, when PFP actually went for that stage. She went about 500-600 meters out and only was caught just before the line. I mean, it seems like everyone kind of forgot that, where Vos was like coming up with Kim LeCourt went and Vos came around her and was hesitating, you know, and finally she took that stage. Kim LeCourt second and PFP was third. And then Mavi Garcia wins solo the next day as the oldest rider in the peloton. And I was like, oh, man, where's the young riders? What are they going to do? But I'm sorry about that saw there. But now since I'm talking, I don't know how much you guys can hear of that. And then it was, you know, it was really cool to see, you know, Kim LeCourt went into yellow after stage three because she was tied on time with Vos but had better consistent finishes. And then, you know, we saw that the sprinter extraordinaire in Lorena Vivas. I mean, it's like she sprints and then everyone else is riding for whatever scraps are left, you know, second on down. She's just unbelievable, the power and speed and tenacity she has. But the thing that stuck with me the most was there was a young French rider, Maeva Squibon, and she ended up getting the most combative award on three stages and won that overall, but she also won two mountain stages back to back. And while that in and of itself, and both of them solo, was super impressive. She's, you know, listen to the commentary, 23 years old. She's been racing for 10 years. So that means she started racing when she was 13, which was kind of about when we all met.
About right? Like us. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. About like us. But I was just blown away. And it gave me faith that there are organizations that are still mentoring riders, how well put together she was, you know, just from her position on the bike, how she pedaled, you know, she could ride with her hands off the bars. She attacked. It looked solid, you know, her interviews, the way she was on the podium, she was just super, super put together. And the fact that she did it 2 days in a row was really cool to see, you know. And then toward that last weekend, it was like, but she didn't have it in her legs, you know, to go for 9 days straight. So there's still something right to go on there. But I thought that was great to see that. It was really cool to watch how Kim LaCourte selflessly rode while she was in the yellow jersey for Sarah Gigante, who, you know, on paper was the best climber out there. Although we all know what happened when we watch it, that Pauline Ferrand-Prévot.
Yeah, right? Races aren't won on paper.
Exactly. And what really matters is how well you climb on that day. You know, and then I did see some stuff in the media after the men's tour, like how the top two with Pogačar and Vingegaard were riding aero bikes even in the climbing stages. But I did notice that PFP was on a lightweight climbing bike in those mountain stages for her. So that was also fun to see that. Right. And I just thought the racing was super dynamic. You know, there were attacks, and it did come down to, like, you know, some of the riders. Vollering obviously had the strongest team and had her teammates there, but she, you know, when it all was said and done, PFP just had the legs and got it through. So
yeah,
super exciting stuff. And it was great to watch. So it's going to be interesting just to see how things move forward. Women's Giro next year will be on a different time slot on the calendar, so it won't be so close to the tour. So, you know, got some more racing coming up. So it was super exciting. That's what I got. No, did you guys get to watch much of it?
I got to watch highlights of, I think, all but maybe two stages. So I thought it was exciting racing too. PFP is amazing. I really started watching her several years ago in the lead up to the Tokyo Olympics. I was watching all the mountain bike racing and then watched her transfer over to the road. And she got something about her pedaling style. She was the same thing when I watch her win these Olympic cross country races, where she can just be going and she doesn't even look, she just looks like she's cruising along, you know, and just, but she's obviously not cruising. She's going, you know, she's definitely going super fast. And so, yeah, she's got, you know, she seems like, I had read something that people were surprised a little bit about her in the tour. They said they didn't know how well, like how she was going to be, if where her form was going to be. She had like some type of an ankle injury leading up to the tour and had to take some weeks off and came back. And I think, you know, Kurt and I, we had mentioned this a little bit, and they were asking, is she going to be good? And I just thought, when has she ever not been good? She's won like just about everything there is to win, you know, in cycling. And so I can get that maybe for a short event, you know, you say, oh, how's their form? And she's an unknown quantity because she hasn't been on a road bike. But I think somebody like her, and as good as she is for peaking for events, you know, how she won the Paris Olympics, you pretty much have to expect that she's going to show up and be good.
Yeah. Yeah, she won Paris-Roubaix this year, so that's the double Paris-Roubaix in the tour. Her Q factor looks really wide. Like, she looks like, you know, maybe the ankle injury has her on, you know, a wider Q factor, like she, or she's something to do with her coming across from her mountain bike. Like, she looks like real wide pedal stance. Yeah, maybe that's the ankle injury.
Yeah, I was wondering that too, because when she pedals, her one, is it her right leg or right knee? I think that's a little bit out and the other one's in. And I had noticed on her cross country bike, her handlebars were the exact same height as her saddle on that bike. You know, you don't really have to be an Olympic cross country, right? It's more about putting your power out. And so knowing, you know, body mechanics, maybe there's some part of that on a road bike that now that she's more stretched out and bent over, you know, sometimes a hip that can make it through when its degree of flexion is a little more open. Maybe as that closes off a little bit, there's no room and that knee goes out. But yeah, I would imagine that has something to do with the ankle injury. You know, usually those things flock together. But either way, man, she's the tour champion now. So pretty awesome, however you put that together.
Well, it's interesting you noticed that, Ed, because I noticed it as well. And DS, we've, you know, talked with you as you've gone through changing your, you know, your stance on your gravel bike, right? You've gone to a mountain bike crank and
for the
set
width.
Your cue out there just because that's what works for you. And I think the days of, you know, as narrow as we can be, you know, are over. More, there's more attention to body mechanics. You know, I myself ride SRAM on my gravel bike and they have a standard crank and a wide crank, they call it, you know, and I put that on my last bike just to get out there a little bit further. I mean, you can obviously play with the adjustment of your cleats. But I think there's more and more attention, like we were talking about with Remco at the beginning of the podcast here, more attention to those smaller details. They're super important. And bike fit and bike position is not like a one and done thing. As your body changes, as you go through the
Right.
season, there are some tweaks that can be made, and it's good to see that there are, a little bit more attention being paid to that. And I think the smaller riders, right, they don't have as much of a bar drop. You were talking about that mountain bike
Yeah.
position, right, where it was fairly level. You look at the guy like a Niels Pollitt, right, who rides at the front. I mean, it looks like his handlebars are about a foot lower than his saddle, but it's a much bigger rider. It's a, it's
Yeah.
more of an aerodynamic thing. I think the aerodynamics is, maybe a bit less with the smaller riders, in that
Yeah, they're
respect. It's
already
not so extreme. They're already pretty
punching a
damn
small
aero.
hole.
Yeah,
Yeah,
exactly.
yeah.
Yeah. So that was it. For that, and maybe the climbing bike is not dead.
Maybe.
Yeah, I noticed that a lot of the women are still riding with their elbows out. Like, I know they're searching for power or whatever, but there was a few women that were, aero helmets, real tucked in elbows and stuff. But there was a few women that were sort of elbows out. It was interesting to see that. Maybe they're
Yeah.
hunting for power. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah. Well, I think a good part of that is there are a lot of riders that did come into the sport that are at the highest level now. They came in during the pandemic when there was a lot of, riding Zwift, riding indoor stuff, right? You
Right.
can put a lot of power out riding indoors, and you don't have to be aero. You don't have to be so put together in how you ride the bike. And I think that goes back to like this Mavis Squibon. She's looks like she's been riding outside her entire life. And I think some of that just comes from mentoring, and programs that mentor the riders and really work with them. Because you can fix some of these, when you call them bad habits.
Right.
But all those little bits, and I think that as more attention gets paid to it, maybe we'll see, riders be more, say, buttoned up, like some riders we see are. You look at even a Demi Vollering, right? Like she looks really good on the bike, a
Yeah.
much taller rider, and still does it. So, and you see it on the men's side. You see some of these riders, you're like, oh my gosh, how does that guy even pedal the bike and get through there? It's
Yeah.
like, holy crap, if they could be more efficient, but we don't know the backstory either. So,
Right.
yeah. I mean, I have to think
Yeah.
with the resources that these teams have, if we're armchairing it, from our living rooms, there have to be some of these people in these organizations that are working on that stuff, but you never know. Yeah.
Well, my own little personal organization that takes place in my service course, my garage, I have a bike fit done every year. And I also talk over my fit with DS all the time. Like,
Right.
I'm always evolving. And I think as I'm like 57 and I'm getting older, a bike fit every year is kind of a good thing. I also changed my philosophy, my bikes during that year. So I'm constantly revisiting and refitting myself. I see a bike fitter every year just for a neutral second opinion. He uses Retool. I don't know how much he stares up at the screen and looks at that data. He uses his eyeballs quite a bit, which I appreciate.
Yeah.
So things changed, bodies changed. These athletes, when they get injured, they, like we look at Jonas and he's had some two serious crashes. He
Yeah.
doesn't quite look like he used to.
Yeah, he looks a little
Maybe his
different on the
back is a
bike.
little bit better. And yeah. So
Yeah.
injuries really change how we all look on the bike, and age does as well.
Yeah.
Well, and I always tell people when I do bike fits, it's like, yeah, this is your fit and here's all your numbers and we'll get you all set, but a bike fit isn't like a finished product. It's a process. And you get those the kind of the standard lines, those points, but you can always make some tweaks, like you said, as if you have an injury or if you're working in the gym more, you get more core strength, your flexibility can go back and forth. Usually it's nothing giant because big changes are often what can cause problems, but yeah,
Right.
there need to be little tweaks. And so, and especially with these riders, so many injuries, it's super important just to pay attention to that. None of us are riding like we were when we were juniors.
Yeah. Sorry, what was that?
I said
I laugh when I go back. I laugh when I go back to the bike fitter and I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah, I got new shoes since I saw you. And I'm like, I think of all the things. Oh, and I changed pedals. And, you know, like, like, oh, yeah, new shoes. Yeah, new shoes. Quite a bit different.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, what do we got now? We got a little more racing stuff. We got there's a big one coming up this weekend. DS, you've been checking out what's going on with Leadville 100, you know, the super altitude race of all altitude races here in the U.S. What have you been seeing with that? Part of the Lifetime Grand Prix.
What I've noticed pretty interesting about that, which was something that was kind of kicked off by Keegan last year in the effort to, you know, set the course record, is that most of the fastest riders at the pointy end of the pack, the pros, are on a drop, you know, a mountain bike setup, but they're putting drop bars on it. Some people are running hardtails. It looks like apparently the course this year might be a little bit looser, a little bit more rocky. So that has some people deciding whether they're sticking with the hardtail or going for like the full suspension mountain bike. But definitely for the in-betweens, the aero areas, they're putting drop bars on their mountain bike, try and shave those seconds, or I guess for a race as long as Leadville, it could be minutes off the overall time. So I think that's kind of interesting. I've had, you know, a little bit of experience with like just messing around and trying to put drop bars on mountain bikes and stuff. And, you know, they definitely, if you have a 120 mil travel fork, drop bars get a little spicy just because, you know, a flat bar, it's way easier as your bike angle is adjusting of the chassis and you're like dropping down something steep. Drop bars are a little bit, you know, harder to make that happen, but there's nothing on Leadville that's super technical. So it seems like, it seems like a good call. Seems like a good call for those people to throw the drop bars in. So that'll be interesting. We see who actually, you know, what they do. We'll see what setups prevailed.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I think with that, crew that races Leadville too, with it being part of the Grand Prix, that is definitely more gravel heavy, I would say, right? They just have Leadville and Schwamigan are the two mountain bike races. You know, it can be a little challenging going back and forth, you know, between those two different setups. Unless, of course, your name's Tom Pidcock, and then you just win on both. But it we'll see after Saturday, right?
That's right.
And I jumped in, Ed. There, you were saying something.
Oh, I think it also depends on your sponsors. If you're a SRAM athlete on a flight attendant, your bike's going to run pretty fancy. I think the Fox Shimano guys are a little bit behind the eight ball with not having flight attendant.
Right.
And it's interesting. Keegan and Vermeulen have a new podcast called The Cool Down, and they actually did a warm up. So they went up to Leadville to train together. And so they recorded an episode before. And Vermeulen is not sold on whether he's going to go drop bar or not. You know, everyone's trying to play to their strengths, you know, like what is going to be their moment.
Right.
Vermeulen is not going to drop Keegan on the descent off a power line or whatever. So he's got to find his segment that's going to, what bike for his strength is going to be a match.
Right.
And I think that's fascinating. I also think that the bikes are really going to accelerate in this area. Like flight attendant, I think, is a huge deal. And I think that coming to drop bars and you see these guys struggling to get the stem. Keegan rolls up on his bike and his stem is hitting the head cap, you know, because he's got a down stem.
Minus like, 17
or
whatever.
There's so much room for refinement and advancement in these bikes. They're going to get better.
Yeah, that's for sure. And I think the suspension component on the lightweight cross country into heavy duty gravel bike was kind of interesting to see where that plays out. Cause most of the suspension, you know, designed for like gravel suspension forks are pretty low, you know, 35, 40 mils of travel, maybe, you know, 60 at the tops, 50. You're talking your average mountain bike fork has double that. So it'll be kind of interesting to see what you really need. You know, how much suspension do you really need? Like it was interesting in the late 90s, probably just into early 2000s, one of the dominant teams in European mountain biking was the Sun Chippy team. And they had Nicolas Vuillot in downhill, who was like incredible and just waxed all of us over and over again. And they had Lenny Martinez's father, Miguel, little Mig, as we called him, and he was winning cross country races. And so Sun back then had data acquisition, which nobody else had. And they went out and they rode their suspension forks. Now, this was obviously Olympic cross country racing, you know, of the late 90s for how bumpy the courses were. But they said on their fork telemetry that it was something like 85% of the time they didn't use more than 50 millimeters of travel. That's how bumpy the courses were back then. So they just designed a 50 millimeter fork. And that was the travel that they ran, was like this super short 50 mil XC fork, you know, back then. So it's kind of interesting that just as things change over time and you're using data, how the courses change, how bigger wheels change it. But it'll be interesting to see where that suspension component, you know, kind of comes in. How much is enough? How much is too much? How much do you need? So it'll be cool to see, hopefully, if that develops a few new products.
That's a company, they were way ahead of their time gathering that telemetry, right?
Yeah.
Like that, I mean, team. Think about that. That was 30 years ago they were doing that.
Yeah.
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 Pretty amazing.
Well, and telemetry is big in Supercross, right? I mean, that's a big part of what they're doing now.
Yeah, they measure. It's amazing how much they have from Supercross.
I wonder with all that flight attendant.
Yeah, the other thing,
if they're gathering that stuff. I mean, some of these companies must be working on stuff where they're starting to gather, at least with some of their athletes, some of the teams. These small changes are going to make big differences.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And I also just think the flight attendant is coming to SRAM gravel group. I just think that we're going to see front shocks on gravel bikes and with the flight attendant, and that's coming. And the ability to lock that out with technology.
Yeah, they're probably going to have
where we're headed.
And redesign the gravel forks for bigger tires. Because most of the forks out there were designed to max out at a 50, but now you've got people using, you know, 2.1s and 2.2s on there. So that'll be interesting to see too, is they really should just do like maybe a chopped down mountain bike fork, but we'll see. We'll see where it ends up.
Maybe we'll see some of that tech.
It'll be real fun to see how Lifetime...
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, how Lifetime covers the race. You know, they're going to live stream, you know, how their Starlink works, whether they use e-motorcycles to follow closely.
Right.
You know, is it loud side-by-sides? You know, whether they're using, how they're covering the race, the helicopter, so forth. I personally am going to be secretly rooting for Simon Pelaud, the Tudor guy.
Oh, yeah.
He's not a mountain biker, but he lives in Colombia, so maybe he can do well at elevation. I like how he just lays it out on the line. He did it at Sea Otter, and people were like, I was like, wow, he's got a huge gap. And I was like telling all the other photographers, I'm like, he's got a huge gap. And they're like, ah, they're going to catch him. They're going to catch him. And then, you know, he went to Unbound, and he got a huge gap, and he got second. So
right.
Just look for him to blow things up at Leadville, and I really hope he does.
Nice.
Well, that's an interesting little bit of intel that he lives in Colombia there, you know, that thin air.
That's right.
The high altitude Leadville starts program. At 10,000 feet, which is, four times the elevation of what I'm at here. And I think, maybe 10,000 times what the elevation you're at.
I have no idea if he can ride a mountain bike. I find him entertaining. And, you know, he even said, like, I'm here to entertain. So.
Nice.
That'll be good to watch. We'll have to keep an eye out for that on Saturday.
Yeah. Well, tires, I mean, big thing, right? Tires there. Leadville. I mean, maybe we'll see some secret tech, you know, on some of these riders that might come out. The tour is where all that tech comes out for road stuff, but you know, it seems like some of these Lifetime events are where it might be coming out for gravel. So maybe we'll see some flight attendant. Who knows? But one thing for sure that everyone's been talking about is tire stuff. So, DS, I know you got some of that, and I got a saw going. I'm going to mute here.
Okay. Yeah. So we had all been talking about just about tires, you know, and what a big part of performance they are. And obviously, you know, road cycling, as people who have kind of like been in it have seen that tire sizes have gone up. Over the years, you know, that the new Continental tire that they designed with UAE, you know, in Pogačar is a 30. That's what they've kind of decided is the right, the right size for performance road cycling. As we get up into gravel, it's pretty interesting. Ed is the master of finding out all the different tire test reports and rolling resistance reports, and sends a lot of that technology over to me. And it's been interesting that, for people who don't know, there was a company, I believe it was first the company in Australia that started doing rolling resistance tests for tires. And Ed, would probably better know the dates, but I mean, it was 15 years ago, maybe, I would think, at least around that time, they started really testing with drums. And, as technology has increased, which is one of the benefits of technology, it's allowed testing to be done that actually can be verified, through power meters. And so tires over time, it's been pretty interesting. Gravel tires have definitely been going up. And originally, all the rolling resistance was based off of drum testing, which you can test for like pavement. And then you can take the drum that the rear wheel is rolling on, you can actually bolt features into it to make bumps. And as soon as you get vertical, I forget the actual term they use, vertical energy or whatever, basically meaning you're hitting bumps, the efficiency size goes up even on a road bike. If it's completely smooth, you can get away with a little bit smaller tire. But if you're even on somewhat rough pavement, then you're going to want to be on a bigger tire for your rolling resistance to go down. And so as they were using this drum testing on gravel tires, it was like 40s were really great, 42s, 43s, sizes were creeping up. And then some people started figuring out with power meters, they started going out and doing real world testing, like pick a mile flat dirt road and average exactly 250 watts power and start checking your rolling resistance. And anytime there's been quantifiable data out on the dirt, the size of gravel tire efficiency goes up, way up to where usually like the 2.1 Thunderbird is one of the fastest rolling tires across all the testing. So 2.0s, 2.1s, 2.2s, whenever you get out onto loose dirt, are the fastest. This is kind of interesting. Even at Sea Otter, we could see how people are showing a carbon frame that's rated for 45s because they probably started designing that 2 years ago thinking they were up on volume. And now everything's standard sizing, like my Mondraker is up to a 50, is the standard size on it. But what the testing, not to get off on a side subject, but what the testing showed is that as soon as you incorporate loose dirt into the picture, volume needs to go up to get your rolling resistance. And so I think that that's going to be, that has just been a pretty interesting facet of tires in general. And we were talking about, is the wide trend tire and gravel here to stay? Well, yes, it is, because it's happened in road, it's happened in mountain bikes. They race Olympic cross country now, they're on 2.4s and 2.5s. I mean, that's bigger than we raced on our downhill bikes when we downhilled. It was like 2.35s and then just getting up to 2.5s. So I think it's been pretty well proven across the board that given enough time and enough data, usually the bigger volume is better, especially on dirt, obviously up to a certain extent. But so I think that that side of it for tires is really interesting. And on a gravel bike specifically, you don't have any suspension, or most people don't. And so a tire is actually the biggest part of your bike that's working as suspension. You get flex between your frame set and some of your other parts, but tires definitely are moving more than anything else on a rigid bike. And so then you have to consider if it's a really bumpy race, would a little bit fatter tire just allow you to float through things and take away mental energy that you're having to put out on a long race? So there's a lot of parameters that are considered in tires. And since I'm a tire guy and have a tire design background, as you all can see up here behind me, I pulled up some drawings out of my tire book, some tire design from Maxxis back in the day. And so, I have a long history of tire background. I designed a platform of tires for Maxxis back in the late 90s and early 2000s, and ran Intense Tires and designed for Panaracer. And so I find the tire info even a little bit extra interesting for me. So yeah, that's a lot of what I've been seeing on tires. What have you guys been seeing? Ed, what do you think?
Well, I think, we're obviously going big, but Keegan's already going small. He went smaller at Sea Otter. He went smaller at Unbound. It depends on that front fork, and whether that front fork is being used,
So when
and
you
how
say
that front fork
smaller,
evolves, like you
Ed,
talked.
when you say smaller, because you know this before we get too far away. So what was what do you recall what he was riding? at those two at Sea Otter or at Unbound?
I think he was running 45s at Sea Otter on a dry
45
course.
or
Yeah.
and maybe a 50, or were they 45s? Wasn't it that Maxxis Reaver? Wasn't that the name of that tire?
Yeah,
I think this is the one that he was
it's
running.
a
Yeah.
new the new one. Yeah. So and then, the Chung Method guy who's got 3,000 followers on Instagram, who's doing category one, two, and three gravel. He has a track, outside his house, and he's getting a lot of publicity for his testing. Is, he tested a 60C tire the other day that was one of his fastest tires so far. So it's a little hard to predict, but the one thing I lean into is it's like, what's your strength or what are you playing to as a rider? So like if you're stronger, like if you're doing BWR and you're strong on the road, you're going to lean into a tire that's going to perform on the road. Like if you want to attack on the last single track and you're going to win the race there, you got to have a tire that's ready for that last single track. So
Right.
it's each rider has to figure out what speaks to them. And I feel like sometimes we're all moving as lemmings a little bit too much, and we need to think about who we are as individuals. It's interesting, like I've been riding the stock, I have an XCO bike, and I've been riding the stock Specialized tires. So I can't even tell you what they are, but I just don't feel like they bite. I don't have complete confidence in the edge and the dry conditions. And so I'm looking forward to, I want to test the new Continental Dub Natals, the 2.2, maybe on there, because I noticed like the knobs have a little sub recessed part, which might have a little more bite, but I
Right.
want to run fast tires on that bike. It's just learning and experimenting and talking with UDS and comparing notes. It's good fun. I really enjoyed the Panaracer X1. That was a great all-around tire. I rode that for a year. My other tire thoughts is like, the short track guys are winning short track XCO on Pathfinder or the Specialized Tracer, which are gravel tires. So, maybe there's a road sprint at the finish there, and so they're playing to that. Like it's gonna finish on tarmac, and so they want to be
Right.
able to sprint. It's just a fascinating topic. It's hard to always believe the data and the testing, and I'm not sure that we really know the answers yet.
Yeah. What do you think, Chaos?
I mean, for me, the most important tire is one that I can get the pressure just right on so that I'm not so beat up at the end of the ride. We were talking a little bit about this before we started recording, and it really it depends on the conditions that you ride in. We always like focus on the race part here, but I mean, right? I'm not racing. I don't know that you guys. I mean, yeah, maybe you go do your Tuesday night dirt criterium or something with your friends and go have a beer. But really, I know for me, most important thing is just is being comfortable, and that's what's going to make me fast, right? And fast is, getting through my ride and not being so blown up at the end of the day that I can't do anything. So,
Right.
I haven't been riding a ton outside, but when I do, I notice that it's like getting a tire with good volume and then good tread. And we do have some, it's not like big rocks up here, but we do have some sharper stuff. So I tend to ride a tire that has a heavier casing that helps with that puncture resistance. And I still don't have the new bike yet, so I'm maxed out at a 45 in is what I could ride now. So I don't have any experience on any bigger tires yet, though I am looking forward to trying that out. I've done great with the WTB tires up where I am up here in Northern California in Western Nevada County. They tend to wear really well up here. I've tried some other brand tires and got a lot of flats, riding some of the same roads and trails that I ride in the same style. And so it's sticking with that. Although, as you mentioned, yes, the tire tech is getting more and more involved, and there's going to be more fun to try out some of these different tires. But that's
Yeah.
where I am on that. It's like best day for me is a ride where I can go and my tires hold air the entire time. Don't have to plug them. Yeah. Don't have to fix anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that kind of lends in like what you're explaining a little bit is your tire philosophy, right? We were talking about before, like for tires, yeah, okay, if you're, a pro racer, that's one thing. You've got a mechanics with a slew of wheels and everything optimized for the day. But if you want one tire that you're going to put on and work for 90% of your riding, is that your philosophy? Do you change around? Do you have two? Do you have one? I know for my philosophy, we have a fair amount of rock, in our gravel riding here, especially on the like short single track and stuff, like some of the riding that we did. And so I like a little bit bigger tire. I'm also, 6'1.5" and weigh about 195 pounds. So I'm not going to run anything that has a lightweight casing. For me, it doesn't matter. I'm not so concerned about saving a few grams or shaving this here or there for a little bit of extra speed going up. I want the entirety of my ride to flow. So one, yes, no flats, is the top on that. And then also just feeling like I can ride, you can ride fast through technical stuff on a narrow tire, but it takes a lot of concentration. When you have a little bit bigger tire on, sometimes it allows you not to have to look so much. You can float over a few things. So I tend to kind of run about as big of a tire as I think works in the situation, but then also for your bike as well. And as an example of that, my previous bike was a Felt Breed aluminum gravel bike. It's rated for 45s, and I could just squeeze 50s in there, just squeezed in the rear. It would fit okay in the front, but I rode 50s on that bike. They felt big for it, even though, and I normally ran 43s and then 45s and Panaracer, adjusted their sizing. That tire felt great on that bike. But when I put the 50s on, even though on the rocky terrain it was great and I could roll over it faster, it just made the bike feel like a little bit heavy and steered slow. Whereas on my new bike, my Arid, my Mondraker is a longer bike and has a little bit more relaxed head angle, longer wheelbase. And I put the 50s on there and they feel great. And so they really feel like they match up with it well. So part of it is, your bike and what you're riding and what fits well on your bike. The same tire, like I said, that felt overtired on my Felt feels great on my Mondraker. So that's something to consider as well in terms of tire philosophy. Then I'm also about, I don't like flatting and fixing flats when I'm out riding. So definitely durability is there. And yeah, I would say that those things for it. And then for me, I also found maybe something that I picked up through my own racing career on mountain bikes and also in motocross is the most important thing for going fast on a tire in terms of handling. Okay, on pavement is one thing. If it rolls, it's a fast rolling tire and you're pushing hard, that's how fast you can go. But as far as handling in the dirt, the main thing is that you really know how your tire handles. You don't want it to surprise you. And that's the main thing that's allowed you to go fast and ride easy, right? And not be wasting any. If you're coming into a section and you're just going, oh man, I'm leaning over. Is this going to let go or is it going to hold? You're going to go into that section timid and you'll be slower. But if you go in, like I love the Gravel King SK, that semi knob. I've ridden that thing so much. I just know what it's going to do like the back of my hand. I come down a trail if it's fast and I look at a corner and if it's loose or whatever, I can pretty much tell how much it's going to drift, where it's going to grab. And around here, that's a great tire. So I just ride that thing as my main tire. And use that everywhere. And sometimes you'll find with tires, I also again learned this from motocross is, you want to know what your tire's doing everywhere. So the tire that's your perfect tire may not be the most perfect for every single condition, but when you add them up, it's going to be the best across all those conditions, for you so that you know what you're doing.
Yeah, you bring up a great point there about knowing what your tire's going to do. I spend a lot of time riding up here on WTB has a tire called the Nano and the Nano 40. I mean, 40, a 40 millimeter tire was super wide, years and years ago, but I got so used to that tire and it was super consistent. Like the it transition, I go into a turn, I never, like that tire never went away from me. I would go into a corner and I knew exactly what it was going to do. And I didn't really, I just got so used to it. It was second nature. And then I remember putting some different tires on my bike, and you go into a corner, same corner you've gone into, and all of a sudden, the front end starts going away. And it's like, yeah, it can be a little bit of a pucker moment, there as hopefully you don't go down, but it's like, yes, that consistency there. And again, Ed, you were talking about it earlier. It's like you got to ride to your strengths. well, your strengths or ride to your style. You know, like I don't go fast uphill either, but I love to go fast downhill. And you know, I've had people say, oh, you know, you're crazy. It's like, well, no, I ride within my ability, but it's also having the confidence in the equipment and doing that. So everyone's tire philosophy is different. We can all read as much as we want online about all these different things, but until you actually go out and do it, then you and figure it out, you'll know what's best for you.
Yeah.
We thought it would be helpful for our listeners to kind of hear our philosophies, because I'm sure tires are the number one topic on the internet. So I'm sure we will bring up tires again. And it's always nice to know when you're listening to a podcaster where they stand on tires and what their background is and their experience, because then you can, like, when they say something, then you can model it off. Well, that's their general philosophy. So it's helpful. I think I would just add that when I first started riding gravel, I was on 32C Sansracked IRC tires, and those tires were very predictable. They were made for cross probably originally, and I just rode those things. I rode rock cobbler, the full rock cobbler on those things, which Amazing. People still like to tell the story of that. I'm not sure my back is okay from that, but I did a lot on those tires, but they were predictable to me. And I also ran too high of pressure because I came from the old world where, you know, big heavy guys need to protect their gear. So I just ran high pressure, but you know, it kind of worked for a while, and my philosophy has changed. And it's so important to know the predictability of your tire. I think that's one of the things that I'm feeling right now with these Specialized mountain bike tires is I can't quite predict them. It's also real dry and arid right now this time of year, so it's not the greatest time of year to evaluate a tire, because everything has a little sketch factor to it. But it's interesting. I ran, Race King 2.2 on the front at BWR Arizona, but I couldn't fit anything more than a 40 in the back of my bike. So my bike dictates what I can do. I will test a 2.1 Thunderbird in the front, probably when I get back to riding my gravel bike, and probably something 40 in the back. You know, I'm curious. I want to test the fastest tire and see why.
Right.
But it's good to know where people stand, and maybe people's philosophies change, and we try new things. I do think that, you know, you hear the Rene Hirst tires super fast, but you would have to run them so big, otherwise they're going to flat. My experience with Schwalbe tires is they flat like crazy, so I have to run a really big Schwalbe tire to get a lack of flatting. You know, flatting is not fast.
Right.
So in order for me to ride run a Schwalbe tire, like their gravel tires, those are too flat prone for me. I would have to run, like, you know, really wide one to make it work. So it depends on, you know, I think supple casing is obviously fast. You know, the race casing is obviously fast, but sometimes that tire has to be so wide to protect that soft casing.
Right, that there's some trade-off. And I think that is great points that you've brought up, and understanding, if you're listening to somebody about tires, understanding their tire philosophy, how they like to ride it, because otherwise their suggestions might be wrong. My suggestions for somebody who's focused on weight and like going as fast as they could up long climbs, my tire selection probably wouldn't be good for them, or how I choose my tires, you know, because that's just not what I base my riding around. So those are great points, Ed, about kind of understanding the philosophy of somebody, so you can understand where their, you know, where their thoughts come as far as their overall tire picture.
Yeah. And it isn't, you know, we touched on, there's so much information about tires out there, and, you know, you could search out tires and, you know, there's a ton of it. And the internet is a great place to get information, but it's not a great place to get knowledge. The only way, right? I mean, that's it. Like, we can get all the info we want, but we're not gaining any knowledge, and you gain the knowledge by actually doing it yourself. And there's no substitute for that. Like, you can, you can read all you want, but until you go out and experience it yourself, you know, you can't really come to that value by comparison. There's nothing replaces that. So just like, you know, that Mava Squibon in the women's tour, you know, she has experience riding a bike, and you could see that, she didn't learn that on the internet. And so just remember that. Remember that, people.
Yeah, you nothing, can't learn that on the internet. Well,
nothing. Yeah, exactly.
I think, you know, I had a thought, interestingly enough, too. You know, you have people in gravel that some people, I would probably say maybe more people come from road to gravel than, say, mountain biking to gravel, although there are people, you know, that do that. But I think that, I mean, I think in road cycling, tires have become more of a talking topic as of recently. But if you had asked somebody even a couple years ago, and maybe a lot of people now, and you think of your biggest performance factors, they would probably say like aerodynamics or, you know, carb intake or something like that of what makes you, you know, makes you go fast, your riding position. But I think on dirt, tires have always been a much more prevalent topic of what makes you go fast, just because, you know, in both, whether you're in pavement or dirt, they're the contact point to your ground, because dirt is just so much more multifaceted. I mean, if you do 60 laps on a downtown Criterium course, if the temperature is about the same, then your tires are going to handle about the same at the start of the finish. But, you know, you can have, you know, riding dirt where you go do one training run, say if you're downhilling, and you go back up the top and go again, and, you know, things can look a lot different. And so tires, you know, really make a big difference. If you choose the wrong tires on a day on dirt, you can just be, you know, flailing no matter how good the rest of your setup is. And so I think maybe dirt people are a little bit more used to, you know, tires is a big part of their bike. But when you think about for gravel, especially on a rigid bike, the tire has so much more of an effect on the overall feel of your bike. You know, if you have a mountain bike and you have front and rear suspension, the suspension that comes out of the casing of the tire isn't doing nearly as much as this, say, on a gravel bike, when really that's the main flexing point on your bike. And so, so, you know, different applications, different sports, different sizes, whether you're mountain or road, but tires, the reason why there's so much tech talk is because it is so technical. It's the one part that absolutely changes how a bike rides, more than stem and bars you put on or switching your gearing or whatever. But tires, I mean, you can feel them, you know, you can feel them instantly. So yeah, the reason why we'll, for sure, this won't be the last talk on tires that we have.
Yeah. Well, then I know talking with you on tire setup, right? As you test tires, you need to make sure you're testing them on the same wheels or wheels that are built the same, right? Different spoke counts, different tensions, different rim material. Like there's a lot going on there that can also, you know, affect the handling there. You know, I see all these people buying these super expensive bikes. I think you're better off having a bike maybe that's not so expensive and get yourself a few sets of wheels, and then you can really test the tires out differently. And then by chance, if you're somewhere and you get a flat at an inopportune moment and you're close to your vehicle, you can always just swap it out and put a new wheel in rather than fixing a flat. So that can be nice.
Yeah. Definitely.
One of my greatest experiments that I've done is run 32C road tires, the Continentals, the STR, which maybe all season Continental 32s. Mm-hmm. Like I remember when I got the 28s of that tire, Steve at Cadence is like, oh, you should just get the 32s. And I'm like, no, 28 is enough. And then a year later, I came back and I go, you were right. I'll take the 32s now. And so
yeah,
that's been one of the biggest benefits. I mean, I really love, that's like a noticeable quality change to my riding experience and how my bike behaves. And I think one thing is that road surfaces in Southern California are just not very good in general. And so a 32 tire just makes such a huge difference.
Yeah, definitely smooths it out and gives you some oversight on cracks, a little bit of sand on the road. I mean, it's funny that you bring that up about how you're on the 32 road tires, because I was thinking when you were talking about those 32 IRCs that you ran at BWR, and I was kind of laughing, going, oh, that's your road tire size now. What was your gravel tire, right? Now that's your road tire, and gravel tires are on their way up. Yeah, so that's a good evolution. One, of course, that I'm happy about, as Ed knows, you know, I've been pushing him on fat tires for a while now. So glad to see him, you know, getting over there toward the fat side of things.
Yeah, I think I want fatter tires on my mountain bike.
Yeah.
All right. Well, tire right. Talk, we will definitely come back to more of that. But what was that? We had a new segment we started last week, right? DS brought up.
Oh, yeah. For those of you that remember the amateur segment, yeah, about pointing out something that we feel is a bit of an amateur move. And so my amateur move this week is actually calling out the press at the women's tour for calling out PFP and claiming that she like looked too thin, you know, as a bike racer and all this. For one, they didn't say anything about that about either of the men's champions. And two, come on, you're racing a grand tour. Everybody knows that so much of a grand tour, being a grand tour winner, a climber, is about your power to weight, that the fact that they would say, oh, wow, you lost a bunch of weight for the tour just seems kind of ridiculous to me. Like an amateur move by the press trying to create a story where there wasn't one. So for my amateur of the week, I'm calling out the press for calling out a grand tour now champion for looking like she was lean in a tour. So that's my amateur for the press.
Amateur, yeah. That's it.
The amateur.
I like for the week. That one. Yeah. Yeah.
Amateur.
The press creating a story where there isn't one.
Yeah. And especially, yeah. I think that was pretty cool that Fran Prevost talked about that and how she said, hey, in the classics, like Paris-Roubaix, she goes, I needed extra power on the flats. Having that extra weight isn't bad, but they've done all the metrics. They knew they had this. I think it was the Madeleine that they climbed. Was that the one that was, yeah, they were going to be an hour, yes, and a half, and they knew that. So they're like going, okay, if you're going to be climbing for basically an hour and a half as fast as you can go, it's going to matter that you drop those couple kilos. And you've got nutritionists and people. I mean, it's amazing. For people who don't know the level that they have at something like a tour rider like that, I mean, they can go off of their power meters during the day and know how many watts they put out. You have nutritionists that when you come to your team dinner, they're telling you how much food you need to eat. Like, hey, you have to eat some more. You're down on calories. You were on the front all day or whatever it is. And so it's not like, you know, any of these grand tour racers are like off eating toilet paper, like the old stories about fashion models used to be, because you could eat that with no calories and it would fill up your stomach. Like, they're doing this science guided. And if it made sense for her to be a kilo heavier and that was where her best numbers came, she would have been a kilo heavier. So, yeah. So amateur on the press for that
amateur
one.
Amateur. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Well, that wraps up episode 4. Thank you, everyone, for your kind comments and feedback. Keep sharing, liking, subscribing. We're also open to sponsorship. So hit us up if you'd like to sponsor and support us at Sea Otter for our big visions or races in the future. And thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you down on the road.
All right. See you next time.
Peace.